This is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver.
This is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh. This is a show about student life, about textbooks, and not-so-textbook ways of approaching being a student. Today on the show, we have a real mixed bag. Entering the studio right now as we speak is Georgia Miller, here to talk a little bit about a paper that she did. We're switching up the format this week, so Georgia's going to tell me about that. Georgia, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for running from class. I appreciate that.
I'm so sorry for being late.
No, it's absolutely fine. So tell me a little bit about this project that you are doing some work on.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting photography. Can you describe the photographer for me for a bit first?
So his name's Larry Sultan, and he was born and raised in the San Fernando Valley in California. Actually, he was born on the East Coast and made his way over, as many did at the time. And he is a photographer by practice, and he's done a lot of works. He works a lot with sort of like evidence and like archival photography and like documentary pieces and all that. So he is really interested in like ways that our couple photography can be appropriated to like recreate a new story or a new narrative. And so his piece that I, or his like collection that I'm working on right now, writing on right now, is called The Valley. So he talks about a lot the mundaneness of the everyday and sort of the banality of suburbia. And so he really likes when you're looking at these pieces, they're these like monumental history-sized photographs of domestic homes that have been rented to pornography filmmakers and stuff to be making these films. So when you're looking at it, you can feel the mundaneness and the banality coming out of it, because you're looking at these like kitchens and scenes that you've like seen 100 times. Like all your friends like lived in the same kind of houses and same kind of kitchens that you're seeing, but it's made uncanny by having like a naked male porn star like bend over a chair or something, or like it's made uncanny by, and he never explicitly shows sexuality, so it's still very censored when you're looking at it, which makes it a little bit more comfortable, and you kind of feel this sense of like voyeurism almost, because you're looking at this like really intensely sexual scene, but you're not really seeing anything, but you kind of are wondering what else is going on. And in doing that, in making these mundane scenes so uncanny through this like implicit sexuality, it means that it just sort of feels, it does feel like a voyeurism. It feels like you're a peeping Tom. It feels like you're seeing something that you shouldn't, but it also feels very comfortable and it makes you want to look more. And so he displays it in these huge like history-sized painting, like that sort of style. So it's these massive, massive works that you can go right up to and just like look at every single little detail, because he wants you to like look at it, write it off, like think that it's nothing, and then realize that you're interested, and then go through all these sort of emotions with every single one.
There's this like real intimacy to it too, like a really, really like intimate look into this kind of like porn set, like you're describing, but like not, you know, there's that kind of like eroticism versus pornography break, where like pornography is like devoid of all these kind of like intimate moments, I guess, like devoid of feeling, and he's kind of like putting a lot of feeling back into them too.
I agree, and I think that he puts a lot of feeling back into it through the use of these like common domestic spaces, because these are spaces that we've seen every day, like I said, and so you give it a sense of, it reminds you that the sort of like sexuality and comforts and pleasures of the suburbia that was promised, in reality, when you're looking at like these homes, it's not really there. Like it's quite empty, and you realize that we live in such a consumer culture that sort of the comforts of what we've been told that suburbia will provide have failed, or did fail, especially in the San Fernando Valley where he was growing up, during the 60s and 70s especially, like the sort of decline of the American dream and the idea of the like suburbia not living up to what it was promised, to the what it was promising to the laborers and the workers that were moving there.
I mean, yeah, the San Fernando Valley is like, I was looking it up yesterday too, and like I haven't spent that much time in LA, but like from what I do understand, this is like Los Angeles County, so this is like outside of the city, outside of the glamour, right there, but kind of close enough where you're kind of like in kind of the city and you're in that kind of Hollywood thing. But at the same time, it's just like, yeah, these like bungalows. And I don't know, have you ever been there before? I know you spent a bit of time in
LA,
right?
I've been to California before, and I was such a little kid, I don't remember where we drove around. But I remember, especially when I was reading about San Fernando Valley, Larry Sultan speaks a lot on how every single house looks like it has its own identity completely. Like one house is Mediterranean, the next one is more Italian style, the next one's like ultra modern. You can never really find some like a specific style that you're gonna see repeated on any house on any street. And so with that idea, he also carries this idea into this idea of identity and how you construct yourself in certain ways to have a certain identity, as these homes would, with its little embellishments and little architectural details and stuff. And when reflected against this Hollywood idea of glamour and of setting a stage and playing a character and putting on a costume, it all amalgamates to a similar.
Right. It's funny. It conjugates really well with the kind of like how porn stars like have their kind of like identities on camera, you know what I'm saying? Like you have these kind of like porn names, and like I was really, that really struck me when I was like looking at the photos of these porn stars. I was like, I wonder what these people's like porn names are. Like I wonder what they like call themselves and kind of how they see themselves when they're on the set. I don't know. I think they're, yeah, it is. I mean, obviously it's a striking subject matter, but there's not much nudity in them. There's like the odd like kind of classical reference in terms of like a breast or something.
There's like a shape here and there.
Yeah, shapes. Yeah,
but it's always very tasteful, I find. Like, you never look at it and you never are like offended. Mm-hmm. I would be proud to show my mom any of these pieces.
Right.
And tell her I wrote a paper on them.
Right. Okay. So, what drew you? How did you first encounter his work?
My roommate told me about him because
okay.
She's a really big fan.
Cool.
And so I started to look into it more and more, and it just felt like the right. I was writing the paper for a class. It's history of photography.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to talk about newer things as well as older things.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point in the class, we had just been talking about documentary photography and archival photography. And so I thought it would be interesting to bring that idea to my paper that I was going to be writing.
Right. Okay, so there's like an interesting thing there too, because your house has sort of become a photo set in its own way, right? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I moved in with an artist. Her name's Isabel Ray. She makes a magazine called As Is. And yeah, so she, just moving in with her, I'd never really been involved with anything artsy, but I'd always had some friends that like had gone to Emily Carr and were part of different collectives and had studios around town.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think it's really interesting. So she ended up moving in with me, and now my house has been sort of this fun art making space, and I think everyone sort of views it as kind of their own studio, I guess. People come in all the time and they'll be like drawing or painting, or she'll do photo shoots there a lot for her, the magazine and everything. And
mm-hmm.
it's fun to know that the place that I'm living is going to be documented so well.
Yeah, that is a really nice thought.
Yeah.
I remember, I think you sent me a link, or either I looked up and saw the photos that had been used kind of for commercial settings too, right? Like
yeah.
For product settings and like interior design shots, and like seeing that, it's really striking seeing like a home that, you know, you're familiar with, but is also like kind of in these glossy magazines.
It's funny too, because then you like start to realize that these scenes that you're seeing in these glossy magazines and these like these beautiful scenes that are obviously staged, you start to remember more and more like, oh, that is staged. Like, somebody doesn't live like that. Nobody
mm-hmm.
lives like that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which kind of makes it easier when you're living in, like, when I first moved into my apartment, I remember like seeing all these beautiful magazine spreads and just thinking like, I could never do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no way that I could make my house look as good as it does. But the thing is that you can't. Like,
with the right lighting, and you shuffle a few things around.
Yeah.
You got some stuff and you keep the tags on so you can return it
Hire
after.
Hire a professional photographer to take it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I really love discussing photography on this show because I think there's something fun about photography over the radio. And I want to ask you, you know, kind of give a lowdown for listeners of how do you approach writing about photography? Like, what are the kind of, like, maybe tools in the toolbox for writing about photography? What kind of approaches can you use?
I would say it's really important to remember that photography can be used for a number of purposes. Like,
mm-hmm.
it can be used for archive or for art or for documentary or, you know, family trees, like some sort of monument. Like, it's used for many, many things. And then not only that, but it can be used within other art forms, like in terms of digital media and reproductions and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think writing about art, it's important to remember its other uses and its history, and to remember why people want to show something a certain way, like if there's any agency behind it, or what is that person, equally in the sense, what is photography trying to show? What is that photographer trying to create and evoke
mm-hmm.
for you? And who is it for? You know, what's
mm-hmm.
it showing? That's
right.
always important. That's important across all art history, but I think it's especially important for photography.
Right. So in this paper that you wrote, or you're writing, are you looking at his entire work, or are you looking at one or two photos? Like, what is your focus?
I talk about the whole Valley series.
Okay.
And then I do a focus on a couple of the more specific pieces that I thought were really striking. In particular, Tasha's third film was a favorite, and there's one called The Boxers.
Okay.
Which is a picture of a really glamorous woman in all white, a porn star, with a bunch of boxer dogs around her. And they're
oh,
all
great.
Standing on this, like, really beautiful, like, classical architecture, like, sort of rotunda, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And she has her face, like, away from the camera. It almost looks like it's a painting or something, but it's
right.
actually just a porn star and her dogs.
There are these kind of, like, I really do feel that there are these kind of, yeah, classical references in his work a little bit. There's these kind of, yeah, beautiful scenes in a way, even if they're off camera. And so with this piece, what's your kind of what's your kind of main argument point? Is this about, this is about kind of this uncanny in the domestic space? Can you lay
That's
it down a little
bit? That's definitely an overarching theme, mm-hmm. but specifically with that piece, what I thought was more interesting was the sense of personability between these porn stars as well, because in the same sense that it takes you away from suburbia and can mm-hmm. remind you that suburbia is a failure and that it is not providing what it was said to provide, in the same sense, these porn stars are also like real people living real lives that have, maybe they have homes or other things that they're like doing outside of this. And so it's interesting, I think, especially with Tasha's third film and The Boxers, both of them provide a very intimate look at what it means to be specifically a female porn star. Mm. And also, I think it's important too to talk about his male gaze over the piece. And so I bring that in with those two more like deeper analyses of the paintings.
Right.
Or the pictures.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because it is funny that, like, right, as much as he seems outside of the world of pornography, you know, because he's taking these kind of behind the scenes moments, it's also, you know, at the end of the day, a man with a camera, like another mm-hmm. guy with a camera.
Absolutely.
There. So what did you kind of glean from his position and how he kind of maybe negotiates his own position in those photos?
I think it's important to remember that, as a male, he can say that he's suspending his male gaze, but inherently it's still there, and inherently he's still trying to evoke some sort of sexuality that is not necessarily his, that he doesn't really have the mm-hmm. the authority to do so. I think I can't say that his work is a failure due to that, but I think that he needs to, or I wish that he would have addressed it more.
Hmm.
I think it's important to remember about the male gaze. But mm-hmm. that's why I liked Tasha's third film in The Boxers, and that's why I liked the ones that were particularly just talking about, or that just showed women, because I think it's important to show the women in like these more vulnerable states. He does talk about his male gaze in an interview that I read.
Yeah, tell me about that. I was wondering if he had said anything about
it. He mentioned he was sort of talking about that, but he also mentioned that a lot of his work, just because it is about projections of... he talks about how you can project desire onto a suburban world because it's something that we're so comfortable with. It's almost like a blank slate. And so he is saying, or he said that for his pieces, he saw it as a projection of his own desires and his own sort of fetishes and stuff, I guess, because he was talking about how suburbia is so close to our own memory that it seems like an attainable desire, even if we
okay,
no longer
right.
live in suburbia. It still seems like a place that you've known and you've seen, and something like that could happen, you know, like a mailman could come to the door and you could invite him in,
right?
And maybe something could happen. It would be a very scandalous thing,
yeah,
but it's a possibility, you know.
Right
And so I think in attempting to reject his male desire at all, he first of all can't, and then not only that, but then it would also change any biases or mediation that would be received from the projection of his desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to just remember when you're looking at these pieces that it is from a male's perspective, but not necessarily to say that it's a failure because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Georgia, thank you so much for running out of class and speaking with me. Thank you for introducing
me to this great
photographer. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Georgia Miller is an art history student here, fourth year art history student at UBC. Thank you so much, Georgia. I really appreciate it.
See you later.
Up next, I'm going to play a song from the Courtneys. This is their new album. It's out on February 17th, which is very, very soon. It's going to be really great. Courtneys are always a good time. So this is Silver Velvet off of the Courtneys 2.
Playing in the aisle, there's nothing in this life. left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Hey, you're back. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. That was Georgia Miller talking a little bit about some art stuff. And then you heard a couple of ads. And up next, we have an interview that was conducted earlier today with the UBC psychedelic community. It should be an interesting talk. I hope you guys enjoy it. It's about 20 minutes, a little interview. I'm talking a little bit about psychedelics and the research that's being done at the university about it and forming communities around that and such. So, here it is. Term, they're looking to promote research and exploration into psychedelics and the effects that they have. Manesh Gurn is one of the co-founders. The other co-founder is Mia Kosko. They are both with me today in the studio. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Feeling great. Yeah, how are you?
Pretty good. I wanted to ask first off, what kind of backgrounds are you folks coming from in terms of discipline, in terms of your research interests? Manesh, do you want to start? Just what's your major?
Sure. So I'm in the last term of my cognitive systems major here at UBC, brain and cognition focus. So my main interest, I'm also a research assistant in a couple of cognitive neuroscience labs here. And I've been involved with research related to meditation and mind wandering. So I very much come from a cognitive neuroscience kind of brain background when approaching these things.
And Mia, what about you?
I'm in my last year here as a psychology. So I'm getting my Bachelor of Arts in Psychology in about 3 months. I'm very excited for that, obviously. And I come from an interest mostly in clinical psychology, so the therapeutic application of psychedelic medicine mostly. I'm looking towards the implications in therapy and practice. And I'm also looking to become a clinical psychologist myself, so I do that by volunteering in a peer relationships lab at UBC, and I also, we both also actually volunteer for MAPS Canada as well, and I also help to assist in a clinical psychology clinic in Vancouver, so.
Right, yeah. And so, yeah, definitely, I know that a big part of kind of psychedelics resurgence over the past little while has been in the context of kind of treatment and kind of maybe new approaches to PTSD, I know is a big one, and new approaches to mental illness. Do you want to talk to me a little bit about that and how that's kind of been shaping up over the past little while?
Yeah, for sure. The research is really interesting on that, and the research obviously paves the way for those therapeutic applications, which are so important, because ultimately the goal of it is how can these substances help people, and how can we view them in a different way, to view them as medicines as opposed to a dangerous recreational substances or something. So for example, there have been a few studies published where, you know, MDMA has been really crucial in helping to lessen the symptoms of PTSD, and they found that psilocybin has been really helpful for people who deal with anxiety. So basically what they're trying to achieve, these researchers that conduct these studies, proving these astounding results with, you know, a very limited but significant sample, is that they're trying to basically show that these substances can and do alleviate the symptoms of clinical disorders and the diagnostic criteria underneath those.
And then there's also this kind of maybe more spiritual dimension, which is also, you know, continues to be really important. Manesh, do you want to talk a little bit about that and what the club is kind of doing on that front?
Sure. So, well, of course, with the reemergence of psychedelics in, like, Western society in the 60s, a lot of it initially was because the experiences themselves are so profound and radical, they often go to, like, these kind of spiritual explanations to make more sense of it. And so, of course, that's always going to be a large dimension of the experience and how it's experienced from a first-person perspective. So even nowadays, which is, well, even in the history of psychedelic psychotherapy, especially with LSD, often the ability for these substances to induce so-called mystical experiences has been central to the therapeutic effects. For example, a good example, in the 60s, there's been thousands of clinical studies with LSD and psychedelics. And actually, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, he considered LSD to be a central part of the program. And specifically, he was concerned with doing high-dose LSD sessions in an attempt to induce a mystical experience that causes people to, like, totally change their perspective on their life and their actions, and that leads to long-term results. So, like, fast forward to now, in, like, the 21st century, there was a 2006 study where they found, you know, and this was published in a good journal, showing that they were able to induce mystical-type experiences in people, and that's the label that they gave them. So it seems like, regardless of what kind of interpretation you want to give, people are having these experiences that have all these different qualities to them that have been recorded in the mystical traditions, like, down in history. So no matter what, there's going to be that kind of spiritual, mystical dimension to it. And it's funny, because even the many, like, therapeutic studies coming out in the past decades, they don't discount that at all. They see it as a central component of the therapeutic benefits. So
that seems like it could also be a kind of tension in thinking about psychedelics from a research perspective, which is, how can you possibly contain or encapsulate that kind of mystical experience? How can you, you know, quantify it? How can you turn it into a research question? How do you, at the UBC psychedelics community, kind of start to think about that and to kind of give some validity to those experiences, while also knowing that science might not be able to encapsulate them fully?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, for one, there's a lot of interesting and relevant kind of literature you can point people to kind of contextualize and understand their experiences. So I think that's very, like, a central thing people might have issues with, that they have these profound experiences, it's so bizarre and out of the world from what they regularly experience, they have no way to understand it. So I think pointing people to, like, for example, you know, a lot of Eastern spiritual texts or meditation texts kind of get at relatable experiences in them that they can serve to contextualize, kind of ground what they experienced. So I think just giving a sense of grounding to people in contextualization and, like, a framework to understand is crucial. And that's something we also try to do with our community that we build here, is for people who do, like, go out and do these drugs, and they to help them kind of contextualize and make sense of the experience through those ways.
I wanted to ask, yeah, what kind of events have you guys been throwing? What kind of community building has been done? Mia, can you talk to me a little bit about the guest speakers you folks have been bringing in?
Yeah, for sure. So we're really excited about the guest speakers we have had, sometimes directly kind of advocating for their research on behalf of the club, sometimes in a collaboration with another club that we're partnering with. So, for example, we've had Mark Hayden recently, who is the main chairperson of MAPS Canada. MAPS, I'll explain. MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Cool.
So it started in the States, and basically it is the main force behind most of the psychedelic studies you read about now, that is funding it, that is getting the research researchers for it. And basically, they do all sorts of good stuff for the psychedelic renaissance, I would say. And so Mark Hayden is one person, and an incredible speaker, and done incredible research. Another person that we had back a long time ago was Kevin Parker, yes. So I got to meet him for the first time. I didn't really know him that well, and so actually seeing him speak was the first time meeting him, which was really incredible. And he had a lot of insight on the fundamentals of psychedelic research and how psychedelics have been viewed in history. There's a lot of history to psychedelics, right? Some of those substances have been taken by humans for just centuries, which makes them so sacred, obviously. And so that was a really important speaker to have in the beginning of the semester, because they deliver their message so well to people, really epitomize this research-based, fact-based discussion of psychedelic medicine. And we did it in the Michael Kingsmill Forum up in this building, and that was a really good setting for it, because it didn't make it seem like we were just talking about doing drugs or substances or anything. It really made it seem like, wow, this is like a thrilling scientific discussion, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So those are just some speakers we've had.
That makes a lot of sense. I wanted to talk a little bit about those kind of stigmas that are still attached. What's it like getting funding for this kind of research?
Well, getting funding for this kind of research is no doubt really difficult. I don't know about the specificities of the rigor into it, but I just know that it's difficult and it requires researchers doing the study to have a really great history to them. So they have to be really well acclaimed, and they have to go through boards that are particularly lenient on more progressive research. And usually it's by donation. MAPS operates as a nonprofit, and so it's a nonprofit organization simply usually connecting donations. And, you know, I always have the thought that, you know, if you just saw one of those people in Dubai driving their 10 Ferraris, giving just 10% of their income to MAPS, you would have a plethora of new studies delivered. I mean, wouldn't you agree? So MAPS is always looking for donations, and so they're one of those sources that really do need a lot of money for just one study if they want to do it.
And what about in terms of kind of like a social community at UBC? How have you guys been going about kind of forging those communities? Manesh, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, so a lot of it is just through Facebook, and it's our posts. We have a really active page where people post links to articles, videos, and so on. A lot of people participate in that. And also, in addition to like our speaker events, we've had a couple nights at Kerner's Pub where we've had like up like 20, 25 people come out. Everyone gets to meet each other, and like a lot of new faces, people from all walks of life, all just hanging out and have like connecting on like a common thing. So it's just like holding events like that, bringing these like-minded people together who are out there and just disconnected from each other. Just facilitating that. It's been successful so far, and we're like growing at a pretty fast pace. So.
That's great. Yeah. What about safety? I mean, in Vancouver, we have, you know, this pretty serious fentanyl crisis going on right now, opioid crisis going on. What is kind of your approach when it comes to safety with these drugs? I mean, I know a big thing is that there's also these kind of designer drugs and new drugs being developed constantly. How do you go about that?
Well, we don't directly facilitate any like drug taking. If anything, we only provide information to allow people to do it safely. For example, like, you know your source, like know that there's testing kits out there to use. Also stuff like, you know, set and setting, like make sure you're with the right people in a predictable environment, you're mentally sound, you're like, and there's nothing huge on your mind. Like, a lot of preparation needs to go into the psychedelic experience. And, you know, this is like demonstrated in the studies where, for example, like they have very rare adverse effects. They do so much to prepare subjects. For example, they often have to go through therapy and see a therapist for about 2 weeks prior to the study, and also take a lower dose prior to taking the full dose, and just be in a certain, like, particular room constructed in a certain way to kind of facilitate the experience. So there's a lot of factors that go into making a psychedelic experience safe and productive. So we definitely just try to provide the information to allow people to do that and just be informed and educated about what they're doing.
Obviously, LSD, mushrooms are the big ones. What has been kind of being developed right now? What is kind of, are there certain preferences for people that are looking to explore this kind of research, explore this kind of, kind of group of experiences? Are there certain drugs which have become more popular in recent years? What can you tell us maybe about the cultural part about this?
Yeah, I could say that You know, because LSD has such a cultural connotation, and it's like so much controversy around it. The majority of recent studies have used psilocybin. So, for example, psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety, for tobacco addiction, for alcoholism, for OCD, and so on. And psilocybin is much, it's a shorter-acting drug, so it's usually 6 to 8 hours, whereas LSD can be up to like 10 to 12. And it's just, people are often more comfortable with it because it's just a mushroom. It's just a natural thing. It's found in nature rather than being semi-synthetic like LSD. So just for like cultural reasons, and just the naturalness of it, the perceived naturalness, has made psilocybin more used lately. But although like in the past 3 years, there's been a lot more work with LSD as well. So I guess psilocybin really got the momentum going from the period of, say, 2012 to 2015-ish. And then now, more recently, there's more stuff in LSD coming out. So it just seems to be moving into a more inclusive perspective. And there's also ayahuasca, which is a DMT-based brew. It's basically been used in the Amazon for probably millennia for like visionary purposes, for like rites of passage for people to like visit the spirit realm, according to them, but also just, you know, work through their experiences and develop spiritually and personally. And so, yeah, so those ayahuasca, LSD, and psilocybin are all being used more and more.
They are, yeah, and to add to that, for sure, there are certain differentiations you can make between classic psychedelics and more newer psychedelics or lesser-known psychedelics. The more classic ones are usually ones that just have been founded or synthesized before. So, for example, ayahuasca, psilocybin, for obvious reasons, are classic psychedelics because they are found in nature, and so they've been on this planet for longer than LSD has, which was synthesized much later on than cultures were using natural substances. And so the reason why I think more research might be conducted with psilocybin is because it's easier and it's there's less fear around it, maybe politically, to conduct experiments with psilocybin. LSD is a little tricky because it lasts so long and because it's also trickier, it's riskier to use in studies because the purity needs to be really spot on. And there needs to be more supervision, and I guess in that more time, so people believe more things could go wrong in a study with these longer psychedelics. So, yeah, that's also some more kind of risk factors mm-hmm. in the research with them.
Manesh before mentioned end-of-life experience, end-of-life care. Can you tell me a little bit about the application of psychedelics in that context? Maybe, Mia, you're coming from a clinical psychology background. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so psychedelics offer so much to the end of life, especially terminal cancer side of health, in where especially notably psilocybin has been found to be so good for those dealing with anxiety, end of life care, and that is to help people readjust the way they look at life and the way they look at time and the linearity of time so as to deal with what they believe their death and their life to be like. So it helps them really reshift their perspective, which has been marred by this diagnosis or has been marred by the other more harmful toxic treatments they've been getting, such as chemotherapy or something. So they actually provide not only a shift in perspective for end-of-life patients, but they also provide an amazing healing mechanism and a way to really reconcile these very intrusive, distorting thoughts that you have when you are dealing with a cancer diagnosis or Lyme disease or even just more livable diseases and disorders. Yeah.
What does that look like in terms of administration, in terms of, yeah, like, actually giving that to people? Yeah. When is that kind of administered?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics, but I know it's usually in, again, a therapeutic environment in a particular kind of room, kind of facilitated to kind of induce a state of comfort and kind of openness to the experience. And often, again, bringing up the spiritual, the mystical experience side of things, like, essentially, in these studies, they try to give them a dose that induces a mystical experience such that they're able to come to terms with their life and accept anything they're kind of repressing or holding on to so that they're kind of content with dying, like for terminal cancer patients. So often it is like they have some time with a therapist prior to it and afterwards after it, and it's all part of a kind of extended treatment plan.
Yeah. Great. I think that's a good place to end. Thank you so much, Manesh and Mia. I really appreciate you guys coming in. Manesh Gurn and Mia Costco are both from the UBC psychedelic community. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Great. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
You're listening to Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. That was Carousel Scene, Red Lipstick, Carousel Scene, just placed second in Shindig, as I understand it. And they were great. I have heard tons of good things about them. I'm playing them right now, sort of as a consolation prize, because up next we have Little Sprout, who are in the studio right now, setting up outside to play for Thunderbird Radio. That starts at 5 o'clock, so that's a live performance of them, and they're great, and they won Shindig.
Yay.
So yeah, it's awesome. I'm here in the studio now with Desi Nair, who is the Accessibility Collective head here at CITR. She is also a student in JRSJ.
Yeah.
Fourth year.
Almost fifth, but it was almost. Yeah. It's at the end.
So Desi is here to talk about a story for the story time segment. You know, it's Valentine's Day, so I wanted something a little romantic, and Desi came in here with...
I don't know if I can deliver.
Okay, so it's not romantic. It's not a romantic story, but it's a wedding story.
Yeah.
So Desi's going to tell a wedding story, which seems fitting.
Yes.
This was your first Malaysian wedding.
It was my first Malaysian wedding that I took part in.
Okay. And this took place in Malaysia.
It took place in Malaysia. It took place in Kuala Lumpur, which is the capital.
Huge city.
Yes. Very big city.
Very big city.
Yes.
And you didn't fly from Vancouver, though.
No. It's so weird. I was on exchange, so I was already doing something international and then flew by myself and then met my family who lives in Vancouver there. And then I had family in Kuala Lumpur. So it was just this big, like, all coming together for this one big event that I really... didn't really know what to expect.
That's really exciting. I mean, it's always exciting, like, flying anywhere, I find.
Yeah.
But you were flying from where? You're flying from Paris?
No. I was flying from a small town. Oh, no. I flew from Paris, but I was staying in a town called Grenoble.
Okay.
Which is, like, the southeast part of France.
Okay, cool. So you fly in by yourself, which is great already.
Yeah.
I bet you were feeling super cool.
It was good because I also hadn't seen my family in, like, 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very family.
Mm-hmm. Whose wedding was it?
It was my... oldest aunt on my mom's side.
Okay.
So she was getting married. She was a bit older.
Mm-hmm.
She is a bit older. And she was marrying a really cool bass guitarist. So
oh, really?
Was, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Guy has long hair. It's in mm-hmm. a ponytail. Yeah.
Right. Bass guitarist. Awesome.
Yeah.
And so was it an indoor wedding or outdoor wedding? What month
was it? It was in March. Malaysian weddings are really, really long.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had the condensed version, which was 4 days. It was inside. It was in a mosque. And then the main kind of ceremony thing was in a hotel.
Okay. 4 days.
4 days.
That is so long.
It's weird. It's very, very collectivist. They want to get everyone involved.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And so, like, is it, like, full day, full night for the 4 days? Like, how jam-packed is it?
It's spread out. There's the mosque part, and then there's, so the reason that there's four parts, there's, like, the pre-engagement part, which I wasn't around for. Then there was, the mosque part where you say your vows, and I was there for that. And then there's the reception, but for the bride's side, and then they have a reception for the groom's side.
Oh, cool.
So
okay, so everybody gets there.
Everyone is there.
And then when you arrived, there was some drama at this wedding.
Well, there was drama leading up to it because I think it was just everyone had to get together and mm-hmm. organize themselves. Yeah, it was a lot, and in Malaysian culture, it's the family that organizes it, so you're relying on your cousin to put together invitations, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was kind of hectic leading up to it, and it was like the most hectic I think people know that are involved, that have been involved in a wedding and a bridal party. It just builds up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was this build up like?
Okay, so the build up kind of started like 12 hours before the actual wedding. So the first thing, we all wake up early in the morning, we get breakfast and the bridal shower. There's four girls, and in the morning... No. It started even earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
Started, yeah, because that morning, someone was missing. Immediately, like, one of my cousins
was
great. Missing.
Yeah.
We were like, where the hell is she? Like, mm-hmm. great. And then we get a call at, like, 6 a.m. being like, I'm in the city somewhere. Come pick me up.
Oh, wild.
So then we pick her up. I think that was a day before. And then the night, yeah, sorry, that was the day before. So we got her.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the city. Good. And then... my other cousin, the morning of, we realized that she's missing and she hasn't been around. And, you know, like, that whole, like, the show must go on. So
mm-hmm.
we just kept, we went to the room we were supposed to do our makeup, which was the cousin that was missing's room. And we realized she hadn't even been sleeping in her bed. So it was like, where was she?
Yeah.
And also, like, do we put the effort to find her or do we go do other things?
Yeah.
And, like, it's just building up, and, I mean, people aren't happy, so we're starting to speak not-so-nice things. And as we're doing that, we realize that the makeup crew is not there. They are missing.
Okay.
They came, like, an hour late. They were lost on the wrong floor, and they didn't even bother to, like...
They were in the building.
They're in the building. We were on the 14th floor. They were on the 4th, and they never were like, oh, maybe we're on the wrong floor. Maybe we should go somewhere else. No, we just... they just kind of
unreal
went with it. And then, so she, I don't even remember when she arrived.
lives. Anyway, the makeup people come, and there's this whole other problem, because I'm half Malay and half Indian, so I'm darker skin, and my sister's darker skin than the rest of the bridal party. And these makeup artists only have makeup for light skin, so we ended up looking like a bunch of opera singers.
Yeah.
And the whole time we were not too pleased. They were in a rush too, because they'd been lost for an hour. I actually got the makeup people were in a rush, which is
also,
never good.
What are the makeup people doing, like, not carrying different
phones
foundation
or
and stuff?
I know, and foundations. Like, yeah. I was like as a DRC major too, I'm just like,
yeah,
because
it's
I'm
a very interesting
some
moment.
Light,
yeah.
Light pale foundation, yeah, put on me. And they were in a rush. I got an eyelash, fake eyelashes put in the middle of my eyelid.
Fantastic.
And when told, they just kind of like extended my eyeline. It was a mess.
Yeah.
They messed up my sister's hair. They messed up my cousin's makeup. We were all just sitting there really discontent. And then something like 20 to 30 minutes before we have to be downstairs, and mm-hmm. we're supposed to be downstairs, my cousin arrives. She finally comes, and that's the whole bridal party. And I'm kind of not very accommodating. I'm sitting there like over top of her and like screaming at the makeup people, like, we gotta go,
oh,
we gotta go. They had barely done her hair. They were running through her makeup. And then we find, like, just as we're leaving, these two women come into the makeup room, and mm-hmm. they're like, oh, can we get our makeup done? We were like, and I'm just sitting there like, no. There's one more bridesmaid that needs to get. Who are you? And why do you, like, yeah, we're the bridesmaids. Like, we're expected to be somewhere. Well, we knew them, but I didn't really care. So I just kept brushing them, and then they ended up doing those people's makeup. So this makeup was going so slow, mm-hmm. and then I just rush everyone into the elevator,
mm-hmm.
And then what happens? Oh, and we're all kind of like really we're all looking at each other like kind of discontent, because like our makeup looks really bad.
Oh God!
Like really, yeah, really, really bad, and like everyone's hair looks bad, and we're just like, we don't
not having it.
We don't care because we don't have a lot of time, and then we end up lining up and waiting for a while because my aunt ended up having jitters.
Oh wow!
Pre-wedding jitters. So we're all sitting there, and then I think it's 20 minutes. 20 minutes before we have to walk, one of my cousins turns to me and she's like, "I'm gonna go get contact lens solution." Like we're lining up,
yeah,
to go walk down
and
an aisle.
She just leaves.
She's just like, "I'm gonna go get contact lens solution." And at that point, it's like you don't really care. You're just kind of like,
okay, do you
so
want.
She left, yeah, and my other aunt was like, okay, we're walking with three people. But luckily, these wedding jitters that my aunt had gave her time, and she came last minute. And just as we're, like, the doors, like they're getting ready to open,
yeah,
the doors, we're in line. There's my aunt and her future husband, and we're in line. We're ready to go. Those two people that had gotten their makeup done come, and they have this flawless, beautiful makeup.
Unreal.
They're in fancy,
yeah,
dresses, and they stand in front of us. And when the doors open, they walk in front of us. We're supposed to, like, do this thing, and
mm-hmm.
they were in front of us. And the whole time. And then on top of that, like, so, yeah, that was us there. And then it was really funny because we'd been making fun of each other about not falling in heels, and my sister wore flats, and she like floored it,
oh, God,
on the way up to where,
okay,
we were supposed
wait,
to sit.
I'm in a cliffhanger.
No, no, for sure.
I'm in a cliffhanger,
yeah,
because
no,
I'm
it.
Getting a lot of eyes looking at me. They have this band coming up next. Next week, part two of the,
yes,
wedding.
Let's do it.
there's more days happening. So this is gonna continue next week. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Desi Nair, thank you so much.
Yeah,
Desi, I really appreciate it. We will actually continue this. But yeah, Little Sprout up next. That's going to be great. So thanks so much for listening.